Hello and welcome to another Jay's Politics Podcast by the Podcast 99 Radio Network. You can reach us at podcast99.org or directly at jpoliticspodcast@gmail.com or at jpolipodcast on Twitter. Welcome to another episode of This Week in U.S. Politics, episode number 13. Today we are going to be discussing a couple different topics. One is about a Supreme Court case that's going to have an impact here in Washington, but it's actually going to have an impact all across the nation. And then lastly is going to be talking about the national public vote or national popular vote. It's going to be discussing, I'm going to be discussing my opinion on it. I'm going to have links to both the article about the union and also the national popular vote, but I don't think that they quite address it quite as well as we like it. And I am sorry, I am actually going to mute this really quick, and I got to adjust my mic. I don't like the position of it. Okay, sorry about that interruption there, but I thought I had it where I wanted it, and apparently I didn't. So, what I've been looking at here with the news as of late is just a lot of little things here that we can do better for ourselves as well as for as well as those around us. One of them I happen to support, and because I am a union employee myself, but one of the many things that I enjoy is knowing that I have representation when it comes to work, when it comes to labor discussions. There are some things I don't like about the labor union that process. Not that I hate unions at all, but there are things that I dislike about the union process that can kind of hold me back, that can kind of hold us back as people. It's one of those issues that's, you know, good on one side, bad on the other, and it's finding the perfect balance between the two. Specifically in this article here, and I'm actually going to share the article here on my screen as well as have the link displayed below. But let's see here, where did it go? Anyways, so this article is titled "Washington's Public Unions Fight to Retain Influence in Face of Adverse Court Ruling." Now, the adverse court ruling is what they're talking about, is this case that's going to, before the Supreme Court, probably in July, before the end of, or I believe the ruling is going to come out before the end of session in July. Excuse me just a second here. I'm going to hide that really quick. So the first three paragraphs are talking about Pam Cruz and the Franklin Pierce Educational Association, the union. She represents the union of teachers out in her area. Not that it's not important, but I think the meat of the discussion is really in the case itself and how it's going to affect Washington State. And that is Janus versus AFSCME, and I believe they also mentioned that up in the thing. I thought they mentioned it. Apparently they didn't. All right. Excuse me. Anyways, the point of it is, in this case, the issue here is that employees that are not actually in the union, that are not a part of the union, have to pay basically what's called an association fee, or basically it's a fee that they have to pay to allow the union to still collectively bargain, allow the union to do whatever they want to do, or allow the union to operate. Washington's public unions appear to be better positioned than many to absorb or even mitigate the likely effects of the landmark court case, but they're still taking efforts internally and through legislature to build up defenses. For so long, we had just assumed everyone signed their membership forms, and it was great, Cruz said. She called Janus a wake-up call. In the case, many predicted predict the court, which leans conservative, will strike a blow to public sector union power by stopping the practice of charging so-called fair share. And I'm doing air quotes here because you won't see it on the video or here on the podcast. But the fair share fees to people who do not belong to the union. In states without right-to-work laws, non-members in union union-represented workplaces can be required to pay fees that bankroll the cost of collective bargaining with the government. An end to fair share fees or agency fees would make the public sector in Washington and the rest of the nation effectively right-to-work. This means that no public employee could be required to pay for any part of union operations. Now, the tricky part of this is in right to work states, you know, it's, you know, you have the right to work, but your employer also has the right to fire you. There are many there's many balances to it. And a lot of these you can actually negotiate your own contracts and things like that. Here's the link that they used in the article that you saw just below in the next paragraph. I'll try to link to that as well. But you'll notice that here this is a list of right to work states. You'll notice that California, Oregon, and Washington, the three major West Coast states politically, are not on this list. Hawaii and Alaska are also not on this list. So basically, the entire West Coast of the United States are not right-to-work states, according to this Department of Labor's source. Anyways, just an interesting thought here, going back to the article. Right-to-work systems are now in place in 28 of the 50 states. Extending those rules would be a welcome outcome for some. Maxford Nelson, Director of Labor Policy for the conservative nonprofit Freedom Foundation in Olympia, said that the organization has no issue with public employees voluntarily joining a union paying dues. And that seems fair, you know? I mean, I'm in a job actually where I have to be a part of the union, otherwise I cannot work. It is not allowed for me to not be a part of the union unless I am at management. Certain management positions do not have union requirements. And so it's weird, you know, how those types of things can happen in a position. And I agree that my boss, who happens to be in a non-union position, should not have to pay my union a fee. Why should my managers be paying a fee to my union to operate? That makes no sense. Now, I know some of you out there that are diehard union supporters, some of you that are, what shall we say here? Some of you that are the diehard supporters of unions are going to see that the actual issue, are you going to say that the issue with the unions is that they represent the people, they work hard for the people, and I get that. Now, I understand that. Why are you doing this? Sorry, I'm going to close that out. Stop sharing my screen for a second. I'm trying to pull up the chat because I always forget to pull up my chat at the beginning. Oh, because I click resume. That's why. Never mind. But anyways, the unions represent the people. They support the people. They support the people's families, things like that. And I get that. Those are all wonderful and admirable things. Those are all worthwhile endeavors. There we go. Anyways, long story, but the problem I have is that I should be, as an employee, in any position, anywhere, in a job, I think that I should be able to choose whether or not I want to be part of that union. Now, in my case, I did actually move up to a position of management and then I went back down. But when I was in that position of management, I had to pay for higher healthcare premiums than what I have to do as a union employee. I don't see a problem with that. I have no problem with that at all. If I'm going to not be a part of the union, I should have to pay more for the things that are required of me, such as healthcare, such as dental, vision, you know, et cetera, all those types of things, I should have to pay more of those since I'm not a part of the union. Why should the union be offsetting my costs if I'm not going to be a part of them and help support them? So, you know, it's just one of those things, you know, it's like, how can we ask our representatives, how can we ask our friends and family to be supportive of the unions, but also support our free choices, our free speech, and everything like that? And that's kind of where the line gets drawn, is what constitutes being a part of a union and getting, you know, free speech and all that. All right. So, hide that again. Sorry. All right. So, all right, where are we at? Okay, the quote here from Nelson. We think, though, that the choice should be completely voluntarily and transparently presented to the employee. Pro-labor groups say non-members should pay for bargain costs because they benefit even if they are not in the union. Without money from agency fees, unions could lose collective bargaining strength, staff, and leverage as they try and push for contracts that favor their workers. Again, when it comes to collective bargaining, these issues that, you know, in these instances where you have employees that are union and non-union, don't always necessarily benefit the non-union employees. If the union employees go on strike, guess who's got to work harder? Guess who's got to work, you know, more hours, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's, yeah, they get compensated by bigger paychecks and things like that, but at the same time, in the end, their benefits might not be the same. Like, example, my benefits, I pay, I think, $25 a paycheck for my health care benefits for me and my family. But when I was non-union, I was paying almost $100 a week. So I went from paying a fourth of what I paid to, you know, what I paid for a whole month currently as a union employee. That's crazy. But that's one of the side effects of not being a union member. Sometimes being a non-union member, you get more money because you're not getting more benefits. You know, those types of things. It's just, it's one of those things that you have to weigh for yourself. You have to figure it out. The case could also cut into influential lobbying and election organization of labor groups. Currently, non-members do not have to pay for political dues, but full-fledged members do. And I agree that's definitely how it should be, because why should I pay for their political advocacy when it's not necessarily representing me directly as a non-union member? I mean, it's crazy. And I will also have a link to this study here. I do have it pulled up here. It's 25 pages, so if I go through that, I'll be here all night reading it to you guys. But I think it's very important to have. In a study released Wednesday by Robert Bruno, a labor and employee relations professor at the University of Illinois and the left-leaning Illinois Economic Policy Institute, shows just how much Janus could change unions. The research predicts that the national right-to-work ruling could cut union memberships in state and local government around the country by 8.2%. That is a loss of 726,000 union members over time. Public school teachers' unions could see membership drop by 4.8%, according to the study. The ultimate effect is going to be the institution itself going to be weakened, Bruno said, of public unions. That'll make it harder for it to grow, and that will de-incentivize people from wanting to be a part of it. Now, this is a fairly long article. I won't go through all of it, but I think that it's important to see kind of where we're at and why we have the Janus ruling, why we're going to have this Janus ruling, the potential effects of Janus. Anti-union groups have long opposed mandatory agency fees, saying they violate the free speech protections and the right of free association. Despite those objections, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled them legal in 1977, a case known as Abood v. Detroit Board of Education. Opinions have appeared to change since then. In a 2014 case, Harris v. Quinn, the Supreme Court ruled against fair share agency fees for a segment of home health care workers that were not full state employees. Then in 2016, a case nearly identical to Janus related to full-fledged public employees made it to the Supreme Court. But before the court could rule on Fredericks versus California Teachers Association, however, Justice Antonin Scalia died. The case was deadlocked. The case deadlocked at 4-4. Now, I honestly think with these two cases here, the 2014 and the 2016 cases, I can agree with how the Supreme Court so far has ruled on this. And again, I think if Scalia was there, it probably would have been a 5-4 decision and would have solved the matter. However, but with it deadlocked and the way things currently are, I honestly think that the fair share agency fee to part-time workers, you know, non-full-time workers or even non-full state employees should be, you know, brushed aside. No, you shouldn't have to pay those because you're not getting necessarily the full representation that a full-time employee is getting. So, but at the same time, without knowing exactly how Justice Antonin Scalia was thinking at the time of the case and how he heard it, if at all, it's just hard to decide, you know, which way should we lean on this? And it goes on to, with Trump appointing Neil Gorsuch now on the bench, and a ruling on Janus is expected by the end of the current Supreme Court session in July. Oh, that leads me to another thought. SupremeCourt.gov? I wonder. Oral arguments. I'm not going to actually play it, but I'm going to see if it's on the, if it's available. They might have heard it. Oh, there it is, right here. Date argued February 26, 2018. That'll be interesting. If you go to SupremeCourt.gov, like you should be seeing here, let me see if that's showing up. Yeah, if you go to the Supreme Court, website here, you can actually listen to these while even reading the transcript alongside. That'll be interesting. I may even link the audio to that, so I'm going to leave that open for now. But, where is it going with this? Anyways, the fact that unions have held a long-term shield of power with governments, both state and federal. It's basically the way I see it. Again, this is my personal opinion on this. But the way that I see it is basically is building up a siege defense against various labor laws that are out there. And I'm not saying some of that's not fair. It's not. I mean, look at, we wouldn't have weekends, we wouldn't have paid holidays, we wouldn't have all this stuff without unions. And I'm not, for lack of a better phrase here, not being ungrateful to them or trying to be ungrateful to them about this. But at the same time, that have they prevented some more, how do I want to put it? Have they prevented some more liberal ideas, some more freedom ideas for people to move up? Just as an example, you know, my fuel station that I work at, we are a standalone store. We receive our shipments, we do our own price changing, we do our own bookkeeping. We do all the stuff that a main grocery store within our union would do. We're still part of the union membership, but we get capped out at the same rate that a fuel station that's attached to an actual grocery store does, where they don't do all the same stuff that we do. But because there's only two of, you can't see me, but since there's only two of us, two stores like ours in Washington State, you know, we're not necessarily high priority on the union, on the union's negotiating list. You know, I do quite a bit of work around my fuel station. That is more than just a regular, what if a regular fuel attendant does. You know, I feel that I should get paid more. Why can I not have the option? And again, this is more to do with, this lawsuit is more to do with the state than it is with me, but it could affect my union eventually as well. But why should I not be able to negotiate to get a higher pay rate, a higher base rate pay, than people who don't do the same stuff that I do? You know, I'm maxed out at journeyman level for my job title. Ooh, wow. So the only way I'm going to get a pay raise is to become a fuel manager again, go into the store, become a cashier, or some other job in the department, in another department. Now, granted, we just recently got collectively bargained that any job, for the most part, will transfer hours. I mean, there might be some drop off if it's not a completely compatible department. But at the same time, why? If I'm in an isolated bubble, if I'm in a unique situation, why am I not allowed to do that? And again, it's because the union has control over that. You know, I don't know how many times in contract negotiations I brought up that, hey, while there might be only two of us in the entire state, as a union, I don't feel that you're representing us well enough. Like, oh yeah, no, we hear you, we hear you. And yet none of us could come into it, you know. None of us are the people. So it is what it is, but that's just my opinion on it. That's my opinion on what I feel that unions do and don't do. Alright, so, and just in case you were wondering, it's the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME. Greg Devereaux is the Washington State's Executive Director, and the Washington State chapter represents roughly 43,000 people and has nearly 36,000 full-fledged members. About 5,500 people are non-members who pay only agency fees, according to Tim Welch, the union spokesman. The study from Illinois and the FSE enrollment may provide a hint to how Genesis could affect the union. Non-members currently pay 1.17% of their gross monthly salary to WFSE, with a maximum amount of $63.42 per month. By contrast, the union members pay a 1.5% gross of the monthly salary, capped at $81.18 per month. So, based on those dues, the Washington State, I can't even think of it now. The WFSE could lose millions of dollars per year if current non-members stop paying agency fees and union enrollment drops. Welch said that the union's annual budget is roughly $19 million. The hit would also be in millions for the Washington State Education Association, the state's largest public sector union. Although it's more complex to estimate, the WEA has about 95,000 members statewide and represents a swath of teachers and staff, kindergarten through 12th grade schools, and some colleges and universities. Under the WEA umbrella, local branches of the union serving K through 12 teachers bargain directly with the school districts. Rich Wood, the union spokesperson, declined to give specific data for non-members represented by the WEA, but he said the membership is more than 95%. The typical K through 12 staff member in the WEA pays between $1,100 a year, Wood said. A fee payer who has access to a refund from the union for political costs gets about 25% of the money back. Still, most aren't spelling doom for Washington's unions. The decline in membership does not appear to be an existential threat to the WFSE or the WEA or most public sector unions in the state, says Nielsen from the Freedom Foundation. Devereux also said Janus won't be on a manageable blow. He compares the union numbers to roughly 20,000 that they had in 1994 when he became executive director. Skipping past some of this information, if you want to read it, link is in the video description and will be in the post below. Legal changes. Labor groups still have made an urgent push to bolster their ranks through the legislature. With Democratic control of the House and Senate for this year for the first time since 2012, lawmakers largely have helped them. Two bills in particular were prized wins for unions in the fight against Janus. Senate Bill 6229, which requires new public employees to meet with the union representatives during orientation for at least 30 minutes. And House Bill 2751, which authorizes involuntary deduction of union dues from new state workers unless they provide written notice that they wish to be non-member or religious objectors. Okay. Hold on right there. I'm sorry. This is the issue that I have with unions. Is that, again, in my position, my job, I am required to be a union member. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I have to be a part of the union, whether I choose to be or not. Now, I understand it's for solidarity reasons. I get it. But here you have a bill passed by our legislature that, unless I decide to declare to be a non-member or that I'm objecting because of religious reasons, do you know how that brands you as a person inside a union? I mean, honestly, that is like seriously just... Wow. Wow. I mean, you just don't understand how flabbergasted I am with this. But I mean, honestly, people, like, if I were to be in a job where I could be a non-union member voluntarily, then why should I have to pay an involuntary fee? Now, being voluntarily not a member is, you know, black sheep enough in unions. But to full on say, no, I do not want to be a member at all. I do not want anything to do with the union. So take me off and I have to do it in writing? Well, you might as well just kick me out of the job right then and there. Because the actual union workers, you know, they'll put on a brave face. They'll put on a, oh, you should really join the union. Oh, the union's not that bad. Oh, da da da. I mean, literally, when it comes to unions, it is about peer pressure. There, you know, you see the talks about, you know, when unions strike and pickets happen, and some employees are like, you know what, I value my job, the ability to provide for my family, more so than I do for a 2 cent an hour pay increase. I'll go back to work, you know, or even being a scab in that case and going, being hired outside of the union altogether to go make sure that the company can run. You know, I mean, it's just hard for me to imagine that having to provide a written notice to my employer that's somehow not going to get out in internal memos somewhere, even if it's not even a legitimate internal memo, but an actual gossip chain from somebody who sees it. You know, you might as well just not work for the company. You might as well just not work for the state. You might as well not work for the federal government if that's the case in the union. Now, I had I'm not ashamed to admit this. I quit the post office in my probationary period. Delivering mail was not for me. But I valued what the union there, because I actually sat down and talked with my union reps. I valued the union. The union actually served its purpose to me. Now, not entirely did I agree with everything that the union had in place. But at the same time, I saw that they were trying to make changes. I saw that they're trying to do stuff. Now, even in my union, that I don't necessarily agree with all the time on the things they do, they're providing more and more options for us to be vocal about it. As a matter of fact, we actually have a potential. I don't know if I should even be talking about this, but we have a potential merger between two unions in my area. Now, they were just gonna executively decide to do this merger without the voice of the people, without the union members' vote. Well, they got enough of us to sign the petition, me with them, that the actual body should decide these mergers. And I agree. You don't merge a union just to help out your employees in a union that's understaffed or anything like that. You need to come to the people and say, hey, look, we want to merge with this other union that's still part of our group of union, but here's some of the reasons why, and these are how it's going to affect you and how it's going to improve for you. Right on. I will support that all the time. But you should have come to me first. It's not that hard. Let me invoke my political authority. Let me invoke my freedom of speech, my First Amendment right to freedom of speech, and allow me to argue with you the merits of issues. You know, like I said, there is some representation that I feel my union doesn't do, but again, I understand the limitation of my position in the union. I am in a very, very small minority, and nor should my minority trump that of the majority. You know, it's taking this kind of out of context or out of the union sphere, but, you know, looking at some of the arguments that some of the far left make about things. You know, there's a minority of people that do something bad in a group. Let's just say, I don't know. Let's just say that there are more drug dealers that are white than there are black. Okay. Are you going to tell me that all those drug dealers that are white are better off, etc.? And again, this is just hypothetical here. This isn't a facts-based thing or anything. Now, say that the black people were getting less harsh sentences than the majority. There's some special favoritism going there. Now, going back to my point, if my little group of fuel station attendants got different treatment than the rest of them, I could understand that, especially without any context explained to the other ones, to the other fuel station attendants. You know, we have to, when it comes to unions, you have to balance what's good for the whole versus the good of the few. But the good of the few should have its voice heard, not just brushed aside, you know, hey, yeah, whatever, we hear you, yeah. Because, I mean, technically, according to my handbook, I'm not allowed to strike, but at the same time, I could make life miserable for my union if they don't want to hear me out, if I don't feel that they're going to hear me out. I mean, it wouldn't take much for me to do that, but I feel that they do so much more for everybody as a whole that I don't want to air my grievances out that way to the union. And I'm sure some of this will get back to them if any of my listeners are a part of our union, or if even any of my union representatives listen to this at some point, they'll know. But I don't, if I truly wanted to make life miserable for them, I could. but I also haven't voiced my concerns in quite a while. So it's like, as far as I'm concerned, I'm back at reset point zero. I need to go through the process of the chain all over again. So, I mean, it's just one of those things we have to, I know I've tangented way off at this point, but we have to allow that. We have to make sure that when we're passing bills like these two bills here, 6229, which requires, and I think this is a great bill, actually. 6229 is a great bill that you have to at least meet with your union representatives for 30 minutes in orientation. Perfect, because you're already missing work. You know, orientation is orientation, you know. But taking that 30 minutes to be like, hey, here's your union rep. And I think everybody should mandatorily be doing it. But if you decide not to join the union, at that point, you should be able to do it in writing to the union, and that's it. The union will tell the employee, nope, not going to be part of the union, and it stays as confidential as possible. But by having this House Bill 2751, having it in writing, if they don't do it in writing, they still have to pay a deduction in the form of union dues? No. No, just because I don't consent doesn't mean, just because I don't speak doesn't mean that I consent. You know, that's like, you know, being pulled over by a police officer, holding up a sign saying that I don't, until he tells me what he's pulling me over for, I'm not talking without representation, and he decides to search my car anyways without telling me why. No, that's not okay. That's not even close to okay. When I was working for Regents Blue Shield, one of the key phrases, and that still sticks with me to this day, is there are two main things you do not mess with in somebody's life. Is their health and their money. Now, not necessarily in that order, but when you start messing with people's money, they're not going to like you. And if they don't like you for that, and then you make, I'm not saying the employers would do this directly to harass employees, but if it got out that I wrote down that I do not want to be a member, of the union, etc., and I'm getting harassed by my local union members, oh, you should join the union, you're making life more difficult for us, blah, blah, blah. Basically, all of them peer pressuring me, trying to get me to join the union. No, that's not okay. And even if I file a grievance against them, who's got the better representative? Them, because they don't have to pay for a lawyer, whereas I have to go and pay for a lawyer. It makes no sense, you know. It's just one of those things that's, I don't think that a job should be solely union position, but I also don't think that everybody should have to join the union. You know, that's just my opinion. Take it for what it is. You know, that's your guys' call. And House Bill 2751 faced the tougher road in the legislature before passing in February with only one Republican vote. One GOP, one conservative vote. One. Huh, I wonder why that is. Representative Monica Stonier, a Vancouver Democrat who sponsored the bill, had several reasons saying she believes default membership is better. For one, she said the state workers might decide to join the union when they are first hired, but many of them don't come to understand the benefits of a union, such as representation in situations where there's been a complaint or discipline, until they are months or even years into the job. And then when they need that benefit, they're not a member, she said. Well, yes, that is a good benefit. But at the same time, they should not be put in a situation where that benefit needs to come up to effect. Most of the time, in my experience, when people have been in this position to need that benefit, they have had basically committed some sort of egregious act, either against the company or against the customer. Now, with that said, some of them have taken up their representation, some of them have not. And Some of them I agree with being reinstated, others I do not, but that is what it is. I got 19 minutes left here. I just want to going to leave the link up in my posts, both on YouTube and on the podcast99.org website. But I really think that you should give this article a read and judge for yourself what you think. And I really strongly push for you to go and listen to the oral arguments, especially reading the transcript along with it. It can take some time. Most of them are about an hour long in argument time with the Supreme Court. But it's so insightful to see and hear how people are arguing their cases against the Supreme Court. I don't say against the Supreme Court. Against each other in the Supreme Court, and having the panel of judges actually listen to a case. And of course, they don't give their decision right then and there. They end up writing up a decision. They take turns who leads the dissent, who leads the majority, in the Supreme Court. But it's just fascinating to do that. So there is that. So again, unions, good and bad, you got to weigh them, and you have to decide whether you want to be in a job with one or not. And if you are thinking about getting in a job with a union, follow this case closely. Like I said, they've already had the oral arguments. You can check it out on supremecourt.gov. Link will be in the descriptions below. And then finally, I wanted to talk about something that came up earlier this week. The National Popular Vote Act. For those of you that are not in the United States and have, and or in the United States and have had your head buried in the ground for the last year and a half, welcome to the world where we have Donald Trump, who won the election by the Electoral College and not the popular vote. Now, what's wrong with that picture? We have the Electoral College for a reason. It's never been a popular vote for the president, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I would agree with you. There's not really a problem here, except for the fact that the people who wanted it, anybody but other than Trump to win, are complaining about it. They're like, oh, Hillary won the popular vote. Hillary won the popular vote. She should be the president. Trump's not my president, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We need to have a change to the way we elect presidents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in the wake of how things have been going lately, I don't know exactly how long the National Popular Vote Compact has been around entirely, but here's the thing. The popular vote bill, what you see or hear, let me share it with you on my screen where I'm at. It's nationalpopularvote.com. Link will be below, but I have a hard time with this one. As a person who loves civics, who loves to study history, who loves to do all this, but I find the National Popular Vote quite egregious in the way that I know yesterday on Dave's show, I said that, it'll be a Democratic president pretty much all the time. And Dave's like, oh, I don't think that. I mean, look at Reagan, et cetera. And I'm like, yeah, no, I can capitulate that. I can understand that. But at the same time, I'm just literally like, when I'm sitting here thinking about it, it drives me nuts that people would think that electing the president by popular vote is the best way to go. And you'll sit here and ask, Jay, why not? Why not vote for the president like we do every other elected office and have it by popular vote? Very simply because there are many states out there that are minority states, if you will, when it comes to elections, when it comes to representation, even in the United States. Every state has a minimum of 3 electoral votes. One for each senator and one for each representative. So that means minimum, they have three. Well, what about those states? You know, why should they carry an influence to that? Here's the thing. The whole point of representation is, if you read the way the Constitution is written, the representation of the people is not necessarily in the White House. The representation of the people, according to the Constitution, the way it was originally written, is supposed to be in the legislature. That is where laws are made for us. The executive branch is supposed to implement them. So yes, the president does, by extension, work directly for the people. But at the same time, the president is not the one writing laws. Shouldn't be writing laws or executive orders. It's a whole other topic. I've actually got a document that has, as of November 2016, how each state has its electoral process by law. You know, it lists the state laws. And that's just weird. It's just weird that, you know, we have 11 states with 165 electoral votes. California, and see if you notice a pattern in these. California, Washington, D.C., Hawaii, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington that have been enacted into law in these 11 states. So that means under this compact that these minimum 11 states have done is basically said that we will, regardless of how our voters vote, we'll vote with the populace, with how the popular election goes. So that says that if Washington, and let's just say another Reagan incident happens, but instead of, I can't remember which state held out against Reagan, I think it was Minnesota who had Mondale, I think it was. In 84, I think it was. I think it was 84 that he won by that huge landslide, like every state but one. But let's just say that, you know, a majority of the states vote for a Republican candidate. By the order of this compact, see, again, this will be fun. Let's say 2020. Donald Trump not only wins the Electoral College, but he wins the popular vote in Washington State, Oregon, California. Well, Washington State and California do have to flip their votes from what the populace says of whoever the Democratic nominee be, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, myself, anybody under the left side of politics. And they have to flip to Trump. Oh, this compact will get dissolved really quick, I bet. And here's why. Because they foresee, most of these states that signed this, foresee it as a win for the Democratic Party every time. Just like I said yesterday on Dave's show, I honestly just cannot bring it to bear. Like, I just cannot stress this enough, how much the National Popular Vote Compact and the Act just drive me up the wall. If you think this system's unfair, fine. Present to me a valid option. This is not a valid option. This undermines the entire electoral process, regardless of what they say in their myth videos. They even have a whole list of answering myths. Let's see here. Answering myths. The National Popular Vote. What is it? Why is it needed? Myth about big cities. Myth about the small states. Myth about fraud. Myth about constitutionality. Myth about big state and big counties. Myth about post-election changes of rules. Etc., etc. I mean, literally. I'm planning on doing a whole episode entirely on the Electoral College. It might be a half hour segment, kind of like what I did the other day where I kind of hopped on here impromptu and talked about the Navy's officer of the deck that's getting charged in the Fitzgerald collision. I'm really hoping that we can come to I want to basically do a whole thing on the Electoral College where I am kind of going through the whole process, both Constitution, the states on how they do their thing. And that might take me a while. That might take me a long while to sit down and record. But I think it's going to be for the benefit of the people, especially with midterm elections coming up. Midterm elections are a great way for people to change things nationally and state-wise, but nationally in our representation and how the federal government is aligned. Right now, it is Republican-controlled House, Republican-controlled Senate, and Republican in the White House. Not super majorities in the first two. Never mind the fingering. Anyways, but if one of those two were to change from Republican to Democrat, the way things get done in Washington would be different. More than likely gridlock again, but be that as it may. The whole point, though, that the national popular vote, in my opinion, and this is from what I've seen, this is from what I've read, you can go to their websites and read their things, watch their videos for yourself. But it's never been about the popular election in the U.S. for the president. And I honestly don't think it should be. Because, you know, you complain about the people running for office. You complain about the people in the House, the Senate, and how they never change, and yet nothing gets done. And now you want to allow this. And again, we have a term limit on the president. I understand that. But you basically want the same thing to happen again. So instead of a constant, you know, potential constant of alternating parties, to now basically want same party. Oh, we'll have an alternate. You'll get elected for two terms, and then back to the same thing because we didn't like what he did or she did. But the point is, it's going to be a lesson in futility. We need to hammer out a better option. We need to figure out what it is about the Electoral College that is failing. I hear quotes there for those of you on the podcast. Failing, but what's working about it? What about it is not flawed? What about it is not, you know, how do I put it? What about it that you find appealing? What about it that, you know, maybe I find appealing, that I find attractive, et cetera, et cetera, that you're not willing to let me have? So, if you're like me and you don't agree with the whole, if you don't agree with the whole national popular vote thing, maybe we should have a discussion on this. And somehow I went off air. According to this, I'm not on YouTube anymore. Oh well. Dave, I see what you mean about YouTube now. Apparently I am not broadcasting. Oh well. So, just as a matter of opinion, a matter of fact, I think that we should end the national popular vote. We should go on from there. And we can figure it out. We can fix whatever is wrong with the system. And I want to. I truly do. But at the same time, we have to figure out what it is that's wrong. And just saying that it's because it's not a popular vote is not the answer. A popular vote for the presidency is not the answer to this problem. Especially not the way that they're trying to do it. They're basically trying to circumvent the constitutionality of the Electoral College by modifying the constitution, by modifying how the Electoral College is actually used and implemented. I mean, seriously, the whole point of the Electoral College is to represent the states, to represent the people of the states. And if you, and the problem is that the states are not balanced in their populations. They are not balanced entirely in areas. Like, for example, in Washington State, we have Western Washington and we have Eastern Washington. Two completely different cultures. Two completely different ideologies in the way that things are done. Most of our Republican votes come out of Eastern Washington. Now, granted, we have quite a few Republicans here in the western side of the state. Don't get me wrong. But we have a far more populous side of the state that is the Democratic side of the state. Or Democrat side of the state, not Democratic. But, you know, it's one of those things. So what we need to do as a group, as a nation, is figure out what we can do to fix it and then go about it in a constitutional way and have it changed in the Constitution. Not circumventing that process by just having a compact between the states, by having them sign this compact saying, if the popular vote is this, then your state's going to vote this way. What's going to happen? Literally, what is going to happen the first time that it happens to be a person like Donald Trump that they're not going to like, and they have to, by the compact, do that, or they're going to have to violate that compact and vote in the opposite direction? Well, I can tell you what's going to happen. Either they're going to vote in the opposite direction, or they're going to opt out of the pact next year, or the next presidential election. And honestly, I totally think this is the stupidest idea ever politically. Hate me if you want. Whatever, I don't care. But honestly, just honestly, try to think about, learn about the Electoral College. Learn about the process of electing a president in the United States and come up with a solution that, even if it does involve a popular vote, it's better than this one. Because, again, this whole popular vote thing is just going to... It's just going to drive you all mad. And like I said, literally, when you have to vote for the nominee that you didn't want to vote because the rest of the country wanted that one, you're not going to like it. You're going to hate it. And even if you get enough states that it's 270 electoral votes between them, that they all have to just basically go with the popular vote, if that popular vote is... If that popular vote is the candidate you don't want, come talk to me when you're saying that compact was stupid, worst idea ever, blah blah blah. Because honestly, you're going to be there, right there with me the entire time. So, anyways, like I said, this is Jay with Jay's Politics Podcast. This has been This Week in U.S. Politics, episode number 13. You can reach us at. You can reach me directly at jpoliticspodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach me at jpolypodcast. Better yet, though, you can listen to us, all of us, on podcast99.org, where you have the Dave Bowman Show, you have Constitution Thursday, the AL Evangelist Show, and many others. I really hope that you'll take the time to go over there and check us all out, that you'll listen to the shows. I also hope that you'll contact me. I want to discuss policies that are going on in your states. And for some reason, my song didn't reset itself like it should have. But whatever. That is the way of broadcast radio. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your weekend. It's supposed to be hot here in Washington. I hope it's cool wherever you're at. Have a great night.